You are listening to Preconceived, where we examine the preconceptions that shape how we view the world and the paradigms by which we live our lives. Hey everybody, I'm Zael Mednick, and welcome to another episode of Preconceived. Snow White, Cinderella, Rapunzel. These are just a few of the fabled stories that have captivated people's imaginations from the time they were kids, and then resonated in their hearts even into their adult years. When we think of these fairy tales, most of us probably think of the Disney films that tell their stories. But many of these stories existed long before Walt Disney transformed them into films. Fairy tales are not new. They have been told, albeit in various forms, for many centuries. So how has the fairy tale evolved over the years, both in terms of purpose and content? How did Disney's new take on the fairy tale transform the genre? And what have been the positive impacts, but perhaps also negative ramifications that have resulted? I'm joined today by Professor Jack Zipes, the leading world expert in fairy tales. Jack is professor of German and comparative literature at the University of Minnesota. Among his many awards are a John Simon Guggenheim Fellowship and the International Brothers Grimm Award. Some of his recent publications include The Irresistible Fairy Tale, The Culture and Social History of a Genre, Grimm Legacies, The Magic Power of Fairy Tales, The Sorcerer's Apprentice, and an anthology of magical tales. He has translated the first 1812 to 1815 edition of the Grimm's Tales, the original folk and fairy tales of the Brothers Grimm. In 2019, he founded his own publishing house called Little Mole and Honey Bear. Jack, thank you so much for joining me. Welcome to the podcast.
Oh, it's my pleasure, especially in these difficult times. It's great to speak to another human being.
Agreed. Yeah, I think podcasts have been part of the reason I've stayed a little more sane, just because I get to chat with new people this way. This is a really fun topic. I feel like I say that a lot, but this one's a really fun one, and I know you agree because you've spent so much of your career devoted to it.
Right. Well, I hope you're not a robot.
So I want to start off with a bit of the evolution of the fairy tale. As I alluded to there, our modern Western conception of fairy tales isn't what a fairy tale always was. Fairy tales go back centuries, perhaps millennia. So what is the timeline of the evolution from the oral tradition of a fairy tale? How did that originate?
Well, like all forms of art, the fairy tale, what we call a fairy tale, originated when people began talking to one another and living with one another, helping one another, so that the species would survive. So the oral tradition is extremely important because everything starts with that tradition, with people getting together at the end of a day or sometimes during the day when they didn't have televisions or radios or whatnot or computers. They got together and they told stories of various kinds depending on the society in which they lived. Now, as the species itself began to evolve and the intelligence of human beings enabled people to write down a lot of these stories, different types of genres began developing in the fields or in the huts or in the mansions or in the castles and so on and so forth. And these tales were meant to enable people to deal with the conditions under which they were living. And depending on your class, whether you were a slave or whether you were a half slave, half assistant, apprentice or something like that, these stories vary. And quite often, people called upon the powers unknown to them who might explain why they were on the earth and what their mission was to do on the earth. So that's how various religions originated, and because people invented gods, different types of gods. And with the gods came stories that were made up, imaginative stories, that were made up about these gods or powerful forces. And there was always a little magic in them because of the fact that people did not understand the natural forces that surrounded them. And so a lot of transformations or things that occurred seemed very magical, seemed like, wow, that's, we've got to report about that. We've got to talk about anything that...
Like a flash of lightning.
Right. A monstrous animal or some human being who lived in a cave and then came out of any, you name it, a princess who rebels against her father, runs away in the disguised as a donkey. There are all these tales circulating. Most of them at the beginning had some sort of religious basis, like we know the Greco-Roman gods, the Egyptian, great Egyptian tales and so on around the same period. And these tales were, for the most part, not written down. But as technology developed, with the technology of writing, comes the publication or interest in various groups to publicize particular stories that they found enlightening, informative, fun, whatever. And so in the early period of Christianity, we see a move away from the Greco-Roman gods because Christianity asserts itself. And at the same time that all of this is going about, more and more people begin writing tales that are somewhat critical of Christianity, somewhat critical of the authoritarian powers of different kings, queens, princes, princesses, and so on. And so in the early period, particularly in Italy, there are two writers who represent a move toward the educated middle classes. And they wrote amazing. These are tales they had learned from the peasants, learned from all types of people. But they were basically tales of the people, tales of the folk. They would sit down in a parlor, or they would form little groups, societies, and they would get together every Thursday or Friday or things like that. So the reading was always important with regard to fairy tales because people really enjoyed them, and you could vent all you wanted by having these metaphorical stories in which kings and queens were terrible and miserable, but you couldn't put your finger on the writer and say, you're going to be arrested and put in jail, because the writer would say, well, I didn't mean you, I meant some other king or queen or things like that. So we have to realize that a lot of what we call folk and fairy tales today were politically critical of what was happening, who had power, and why they had power, and so on, including critiques of the sorcerers or priests, and so on and so forth. But moving into the 17th century, toward the end of it, in King Louis XIV's court, there were about 12 or more female writers who were superb. And the leading one was a woman called Madame d'Aulnoy, Catherine d'Aulnoy. And she is the first one who, when one of her two-volume collection of tales were published, she called them contes de fées. And she was the first one who used the term tale of fairies, okay, contes de fées. In all of the tales that were called contes de fées, the power returns to fairies. The fairies replace the Greek gods. And so these fairies are extremely powerful just in this brief period in France, but it had a tremendous effect on opera, ballet, and other kinds of art in the 17th and 18th centuries. And eventually, this movement, until the Napoleonic Wars, this movement moved to Germany. And so you get the German romantics. There's a lot of appropriation of tales. The next great period for the fairy tale was the phase of the three-phased period of the German romantics. So that's the rise at this time is in Germany, followed by England. But I think what I'd like to emphasize right now is that the middle classes are coming to power. You know, we're getting revolutions, numerous types of states are being formed, principalities are being done away with. So it's a period, the 19th century is a long period of new evolution with regard to societies, networks that were being built, with regard to communication and art. And it was a period when also Karl Marx and the socialism and anarchism begins developing in the latter part of the 19th century with new technologies, trains, electricity, and so on and so forth. So it's a new ball game. Nevertheless, all of these magical tales are still highly significant and have become almost essential because most of the best tales, which we have kept with us, speak to unresolved problems among human beings that are so essential to our survival, we tend to remember them in our brain as memes. Information, or it could be a color, it could be a one line, or it could be a single thing of some kind, but it's informative. So if you look now going back at all the tales that people have told, there are billions and trillions of tales. Not all of them stick in our brains as memes, but some do. Like if we take Little Red Riding Hood, and I've written a book a long time ago about the trials and tribulations of Little Red Riding Hood, but I use Little Red Riding Hood now as an example of why we see Little Red Riding Hood almost everywhere, on television, internet, plays, jokes, advertisements, you name it. Little Red Riding Hood and the wolf, of course, a man, werewolf, originally werewolf. This is a tale about rape. It's a tale about the violation of a young girl by a man, by a wolf, by a beastly man. And there, again, probably hundreds of thousands of variations, adaptations of this one tale. It doesn't always stick in our brain exactly as the way the Grimm's and Perrault, in the tale that Perrault wrote, she's killed and that's it. It ends. Little girls who invite wolves into their parlors deserve what they get.
Wow.
Yeah, that's how the French version of Perrault in 1697, that's how it ends.
And then how did the Grimm's adjust that?
The Grimm's end with a hunter coming by. Because a girl can't save herself. The wolf has already eaten grandma and Little Red Riding Hood, and he's sleeping on a bed, generally speaking, and has a big tummy. And as a hunter comes by, he hears some snoring. He goes into the hut or cabin and sees the wolf there, takes a knife, rips open his tummy with a knife, and out pops grandma, out pops Little Red Riding Hood, and the hunter says, go and get some rocks and put them in his tummy. And the rocks are poured in. The grandma sews up the tummy. And then when the wolf wakens, he goes outside and his tummy is so heavy that he falls down into a well and dies. And there's another ending that they attach to their ending as well. So in other words, already within 100 years or more, the tale has greatly changed. The one that I love the most is about a little girl. Her name is not named Little Red Riding Hood. She's just a young peasant, about 10, 11, 12 or so. And her mother says, go to grandma like you always do and bring her this wine. So she goes off on her way and she meets a werewolf. Not a wolf, a werewolf. And the werewolf says, where are you going? And she tells him, et cetera, et cetera. He departs and gets there first, eats the grandmother, takes some of her blood, pours it into a bottle, and puts some of her flesh into a bowl, jumps into bed, and waits for the girl to arrive. The girl arrives and notices that there's something strange going on, and just as she's putting something down on the table, there's a bird or a cat that says, a whore is she who wants to spend time with a werewolf. And so she's alerted by what is going on. And the wolf, then the werewolf says, why don't you sit down at the table, my dear? And he's in the bed. And he says, why don't you have some of the meat that's in the bowl and have some of the wine? And again, when she does eat the flesh of her grandmother and drinks the wine, again, the bird or cat says, again, you're a whore if you do this. And now the werewolf says, why don't you take off your clothes, my dear, and get into bed? And she does that. But she does a striptease. She takes off her blouse and says, what should I do with this, granny? And he says, throw it into the fire, my dear. You won't be needing it. So with every article of clothing, she throws and gets into bed nude. And then there are the famous three questions. And with the final question, which is always, what big teeth you have, the girl at this point says, oh, granny, no, I can't. I've got to go. And then the werewolf says, well, do it in bed, my dear. No, granny, I've got to go caca. And he says, okay, go outside through the window. And he ties a rope around her ankle. And she goes through the window and goes over to a peach tree or pear tree and unties the rope around the tree and starts running off toward home. And in the meantime, the werewolf is sitting there. And then finally he says, what are you doing out there? What are you doing? Are you making a load? And he runs to the window and realizes that he's been tricked. And he jumps through the window and runs after, but never succeeds in capturing her.
Well, it's fascinating because when you say Red Riding Hood, and then you initially talk about how this originated as a story about rape, that's not what most people are thinking about when you hear Red Riding Hood, because the way that these fairy tales and stories have evolved over time, it's kind of been watered down, a lot of these stories, where that social commentary, yes, of course there's social commentary that we're aware of in the fairy tales we know of in their current forms, but that social commentary has been diluted compared to what you're describing, up to the point where very few people would have known that that story was a commentary about rape.
Well, now there was a big wave, titanic wave, in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s of feminism. And it brought out some of the best versions of Little Red Riding Hood by feminists. And they recognized it right away. The women discovered from other writers or just realized that the milk they were giving through this watered down story to their children was poisonous. In other words, these sweet Disney-like versions really covered up what was deep down crucial for the continued existence of this tale. Why does this tale exist? It exists because in most people's minds, little girls really want to be raped. Little girls who invite wolves into their palace deserve what they get. And in fact, most men think that. You wanted it. The girl who goes off and drinks at a party, is having a great old time and is a little loose, and some guy thinks, she wants it or I want. That's typical in all countries, and in some countries worse than others.
That's a definitely apt topic in these times when there's a lot of attention, rightfully so, being brought to that topic of sexual assault, where that is a really false misconception about how rape and sexual violence occurs.
Exactly. Yeah. There are a lot of false assumptions about, the greatest false assumption about fairy tales is that they were written for children, which is stupid, totally stupid and wrong. Fairy tales were not spoken for children or written for children. That comes in the 19th century, in the latter part of the 19th century. These tales were tales for adults.
So when things begin to change, and I know there's a lot of history that we're not discussing up until the point where Disney comes along and really transforms things. Yes. When Disney comes along and he transforms the fairy tale and I think it's fair to say, waters it down and changes the tone more directed to kids, perhaps. Is that a good thing? I mean, I can think of many negative things about it.
You know, there are Disney and his crew in the 1930s, they also did some very short films. And they did play around, and there was a lot of sexual suggestion. And they, in fact, in the 1930s, I think it was 1934, films that showed too much sex or violence were banned. And so they had to clean up, even Disney, and they had to clean up their films. And so it's not totally their fault, you know, that they sweetened their films, their animated films and so on. Our society, or some people in our society, wanted these films to be more, let's say, pedantic, a little more moralistic, and things like that.
Was Disney's goal when he started transforming these stories, was it, this is going to be better commercially, or was it from a genuine place of, let's come up with these more positive stories that could be endearing to kids and perhaps inspire them to believe in this higher dream? Similar in many ways to the still reflecting society, but the American dream that maybe was developing at the same time.
Again, we've got to remember that most people could not afford the cinema at the beginning of the 20th century. And number two, most of the animated films and silent films were made for adults, even if they were fairy tales. And there were tons of fairy tales. So all of these films from the very beginning, Disney wanted to make money. He was a smart man, came from a sort of a lower middle class family. And for him to succeed in animation with his brother was very, very significant. And he had some hard times in the 1920s. So Disney was always, like most people who come from lower class families, really want to better themselves through money. You need money in America in a capitalist system. Otherwise, and you need to have power. You need power. And he learned that lesson when some of his early films were stolen or plagiarized by somebody else or distributed by someone else. And so Disney became with his brother, they became really aware of these sort of wolves in LA and the coasts. So yeah, he, I would say, was fiercely protective of anything he did from the 1930s on. So what happens to Disney is that he really needs a blockbuster film in order to establish his name even more so than it was at the beginning of the 1930s. And that was in the planning of Snow White. That went into the planning. Snow White was intended to be a good film, but he had to watch out and not make it too much sex or violence. And that was the film that really brought him fame.
You've described that as the first definitive animated fairy tale film.
Yes, it definitely is. And it's a film sort of based on a lot of theories about the theater, the well-made play. So Disney's up today, and part of the success of the corporation today is the films are always going to be well-made, and you're always going to get the same story time and time again. There's not one single story, including Frozen, which was a big hit, that is different from Snow White, really.
How so? That there's...
It's a story about elitism. It's a story about protecting elitist, genuine, almost, what could say, racist. It's a racist notion that only the beautiful, wealthy, handsome, knowledgeable people should succeed in the world, and they should control the world. And that basically is the implied message, including The Lion King. I mean, it's a perfect example, but all the other fairy tale films as well. It's always the upper classes who triumph in the end and maintain their, let us say, their racial signs that really mock them as necessary for the world.
It's interesting because when you say that, I think of some of these stories, and I thought you were going in the direction there of damsel in distress who's maybe from the lower class, and it's a message on how the lower class can prevail. But when you think about it, at the end of these movies, Snow White marries a prince, and she goes and joins that higher society. Cinderella marries a prince, joins that higher society. Frozen, which, as you said, there's a variation because there's not the male figure who's rescuing the female. The females are helping each other, but they are royalty still. So,
yes, the message is we live to make them famous. We work to make them famous and strong. And anything that we do that might upset the system, we will be jailed, humiliated, done away with, quieted, and so on and so forth. So the story that Disney's, it's Disney's story anyway, because Disney rises, you know, from the lower classes to become King Disney.
But the message is that you can rise to be King Disney. The message is Aladdin can become royalty. I guess the message, which maybe I missed or many people have missed on some level, is that it's okay to be lower class. It's okay to be in that situation. But how many of these heroines and heroes are actually maintaining that lower status position by the end of the film?
Right. You have to comply. You must comply with the system and behave in a certain way in order to be accepted and to really rise as far as you can go. If you don't do that, you're not going to rise. You're not going to participate in all the joys of the world. And you basically are going to stay in your measly lower class home, and you watch TV and some other things that have been invented to distract us from what is important in the world.
Another related feature of a lot of these stories is the happy ending. And most Disney stories have happy endings.
Yes.
Is there a danger in Disney's focus on happy endings? Because I know there are. I see potential issues. One, that it can permeate into society and in many ways has, like I alluded to in The American Dream before, that people expect happy endings in their lives. As long as they work hard, they'll get those happy endings. And like you just said, they'll elevate their status. And then the other problem with the happy ending is that the stories all end at that happy ending, but they never focus on what happens after that, which is real life.
That's it. You hit it. The happy ending is the beginning of the real problems.
Yes.
Anyone who knows, who has a relationship with somebody else, or anybody who gets married and takes vows to be true and so on, that really the wedding or the happy ending is really the beginning of a new film, should be the beginning of a new film, because that's when the problems occur. How do we live together in societies where we are supposed to be faithful always to our mate, when we know 60 or 70% of marriages break up, or there's deception and things like that? Disney Corporation actually in the 60s, I think, started making sequels to some of the Disney films. And they were, I think, the Little Mermaid. They made about two or three sequels to what happens afterwards. And it's quite hilarious to watch these endings, which are filled with even more sweetness because of the fact that they really can't do a film that's very tragic or complex and so on. Disney sort of, I would say, the Disney ideology is to dumb down people so that they really can't think critically.
When you look at fairy tales now in Disney on a whole and the impact that it's had, We focus on the show a lot about preconceptions, and a lot of our preconceptions are formed when we're so young, when we're watching movies like these, which are telling us certain stories about what love should be, what a happy ending should be, how if you only dream big, then you will achieve whatever you want. Those preconceptions then become so indoctrinated into people. Do you think that Disney overall has had a positive impact on the fairy tale and people's lives? or do you think that it's done more damage in some ways?
Oh, no doubt, much more damage than we realize. People don't face up to it. People don't want to think about it. Disney has had the seal of good housekeeping. And you never want to, with the theme parks and films of different kinds and so on and so forth. But ultimately, as I said before, the ideology of the Disney films is basically an elite ideology in which people are socialized to believe in actually a types of behavior and thinking that really are used by corporations and companies, and I would even say universities, to prolong a type of power structure that really does not allow for a great deal of autonomy and individual thinking. And so if you develop stories that basically lead people not to think, and not to think for themselves, and not to really question authority, then you're going to get a society like ours today in which fascism is a real danger now. And I won't call Disney a fascist. Of course, a lot of people thought he was a type of authoritarian controller of the fiefdom that he built up. He was really, truly like a king who rose from the lower classes.
This episode of the Preconceived Podcast is brought to you by Speaker Labs. Speaker Labs helps people become rockstar public speakers. Most people think public speaking is a unique skill that only a select few possess. At Speaker Labs, they disagree. To them, public speaking isn't a unique skill set. It's a unique context for a skill that all humans already possess: communication. If you can communicate, you can public speak. All you need to do is change the way you think. Speaker Labs will show you how. Visit courses.speakerlabs.ca and use the code PRECONCEIVED at checkout for 50% off of your lifetime access to Speaker Labs' brand new online course, The Lab. I've checked The Lab out, and I can tell you firsthand it is awesome, and it's helped me not only with presentations and public speaking in general, but even with this podcast. So I highly recommend you check this out and use the code PRECONCEIVED for 50% off. Jack, I think you've done a really amazing job, and I mean, you are the world's foremost expert on this, in explaining the evolution of the fairy tale, and especially where we're at now and the status of Disney. One interesting thing that you said was related to Frozen, because a lot of people look at Frozen as Disney has really progressed, they've really changed their tune. But perhaps, as you said, the story hasn't really changed since Snow White. Where do you hope that the fairy tale goes after all your years studying this and after seeing it for several decades evolve? What do you hope is the future for fairy tales? And obviously Disney is a part of that.
Well, I think that, you know, there are already great animators like Miyazaki, the Japanese, a great director of Japanese animated films, which are much different and more complex, more frank about all types of social and familial problems that we have in the world. But Miyazaki's not the only person. There's an entire group in Ireland. There are many other animators that we don't get to see. Why don't we get to see them? Oh, might the Disney Corporation be blocking other animators from showing their works in America? Well, in fact, sadly, yes. So there are, in every country now in the world where films are being produced, fascinating interpretations of all sorts of fairy tales. So it's a question of time, of breakthrough. People, after a while, are getting tired of these repetitive films and theme parks and so on. So I think that I'm very hopeful that there are the young people who are making animated films are going to be much more inventive, much more serious about social problems, try to create audiences who will ponder their own lives, how their lives are related to the particular films or plays or operas. In other words, this has been going on, but we don't know about it. Okay, it's blocked. These films do not have, say, the distribution that a company like Disney or other larger companies, Disney is not the only company that's blocking or making inane films. So I am hopeful. And I think that once the coronavirus ends, we might be very surprised because people have become amazingly inventive in terms of communicating with one another since we can't go to major theaters. A lot of talented people are using the media to make us think, to give us enjoyment, to give us hope, to allow us to celebrate and to be joyful. So, yeah, I'm hopeful.
Well, I think those are really positive words to end on. And it's been really enlightening chatting with you and seeing a side of fairy tales in Disney that a lot of us probably definitely overlooked when we were younger that had long-lasting effects on us. But it's refreshing to get a different perspective from an expert like you and also hear some hope about the future. So thank you so, so much for taking this time with me.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. It's been my pleasure.
So thank you, Professor Jack Zipes, and thank you everybody for listening to another episode of Preconceived. If you want to follow us on Instagram to get some updates on new episodes and some new content, you can follow us at Preconceived_podcast on Instagram. Have a great day.